Good morning. This is the KABU Morning News for Tuesday, January 24th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson. Coming up on this morning's news, the Oregon AFL-CIO plans to file a ballot measure this week to force Walmart to spend more money on health insurance for their employees.
And Pakistan's Prime Minister Shaukat Aziz will meet with President Bush today.
The World Economic Forum meeting this week in Switzerland ranks the U.S. 28th in green policy.
In Portland area weather today, partly to mostly sunny after areas of morning fog inland. Highs in the 50s tonight, partly cloudy, areas of low fog, temperatures in the 40s, 30s at higher elevations.
The Oregon AFL-CIO plans to file a ballot measure this week to force Walmart and other large Oregon employers to spend more money on health insurance programs for their employees. The proposed initiative is patterned after a new Maryland law and is part of a nationwide effort by labor unions to try to extend health insurance to more people who currently lack coverage, even though they have jobs. The Oregon proposal would require employers with more than 4,500 employees to spend at least 9% of payroll on employee health insurance. Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain says the requirement would apply to about a dozen of the state's largest employers, some of whom already offer health insurance to their workers. Walmart spokeswoman Amy Hill says the Oregon measure is part of an overall strategy by unions to tarnish Walmart, and that it would do little to provide health coverage to more people.
Portland commissioners say they're dead serious about invoking a never-used 75-year-old law to force Portland General Electric to lower customer bills if a city-led investigation substantiates suspicions of inflated rates under Enron's ownership. Any aggressive effort to lower rates could run into an immediate tangle of practical, legal, and political challenges, according to utility attorneys and energy consultants. The likely results, the city, PGE, and possibly other Oregon towns in the utilities market territory would end up in court. Portland customers account for roughly one quarter of PGE's retail revenue, and any effort to lower rates would meet fierce resistance from utility officials. PGE officials have said the city's objections to the utility's rates are unfounded. The 50 other Oregon cities in PGE's service territory could either object to Portland's more favorable rates or clamor for equal treatment. A state law adopted in 1931 gives cities the authority to set the rates of corporate-owned utilities, essentially overriding the powers of the PUC. The provision, part of ORS 221.420, has never been used. Under the state law, the city would submit a new rate package to the PUC for review if state regulators concluded that the revamped rates weren't in the public interest. The matter would go to the Portland residents for a vote. This from the Oregonian.
Federal officials are warning that undocumented immigrants who have ignored deportation orders and are hiding out in Oregon may soon get an early morning knock on the door or an unexpected visit at work. By the end of the year, 52 fugitive hunting teams within U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement will be in place specifically to track them down. Two teams will operate in Oregon and Washington. Neil Clark, the field office director for the agency's detention and removal operations, said there are about 3,500 fugitive immigrants in Oregon. Nationally, there are more than 500,000 fugitive immigrants. Clark said that if people are cooperative, the agency will give them a chance to take care of family matters before they are sent out of the country. He said that fugitive hunting teams are not the decision makers in immigration matters, but simply are enforcing a judge's order. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Independent candidates, already a rare breed in Oregon, could be headed for extinction under a new, barely noticed law that took effect this month. Legislative leaders and other state lawmakers who supported the change say they were trying to keep the Oregon elections fair and honorable when they tightened restrictions on who can sign a nomination petition. But critics say the new language makes it far more difficult for unaffiliated candidates to get on the ballot. They call it a thinly veiled power grab by Republican and Democratic Party leaders to keep competition at bay and reduce the risk of spoiler candidates affecting close races. Oregon is one of a handful of states making it harder for independents to run for office. The law changes come against a backdrop of a growing number of voters declining to affiliate with any political party. Of the state's approximately 2 million registered voters, About 22% don't belong to a political party. Before the new law, any registered voter could sign a nominating petition for an independent candidate or attend a nominating convention. Now, anyone who votes in a primary election cannot also help nominate an independent candidate, regardless of whether the voter signs a petition before or after the primary. And a voter may not sign a petition for more than one candidate. This from the Oregonian.
Officials representing Bay Area governments are working on a bid that would help pay for anti-terrorist and disaster preparedness programs. A panel representing 12 Bay Area cities and Alameda and Santa Clara counties are preparing a regional application for a share of the $765 million pot of federal anti-terrorism and disaster funds. The money would be used to pay for anti-terrorist and disaster preparedness training, equipment, and programs. This year is the first time Bay Area governments have to develop a joint grant application. The cities of San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose, and the counties of Alameda and Santa Clara will be voting members of the panel. San Francisco gets two votes because it is a combined city and county government.
Disclosures that companies are selling private phone records have lawmakers and federal regulators moving to try and halt the practice. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said in a statement yesterday that he will work with the head of the Senate Commerce Committee, Ted Stevens, on a bill to criminalize the act. The companies that offer people cell and landline records can get the information a few different ways. One method is called pretexting, in which data brokers, or those working for them, call a phone company pretending to be a customer and persuade it to release the information. Pretexting for financial data is illegal. But there's no specific law against pretexting for phone records. The data brokers also can use insiders at the phone companies to get the records. The Federal Communications Commission is investigating the online data brokers. The agency is subpoenadatafind.org and locatecell.com for information on how they obtain the phone numbers. A follow-up letter sent last week gave the websites a week to comply before facing fines of up to $11,000 for each day they are in violation of the citation.
Several explosions in southern Russia early Sunday morning have suspended gas and electricity supplies to Georgia and further strained the already tense relationship between the two countries. From Tbilisi, FSRN's Deborah Wild reports.
Details of a memo written by a Halliburton official, William Granger, on July 15th revealed that both civilian and military base camp populations had been exposed to an untreated and unsafe water source for possibly up to a year. Halliburton has denied the charges. However, their own former water expert, Bing Carter, had already tested and affirmed that the water was, quote...
Sorry, I had a little technical difficulty there. Lawmakers pledged to step up federal oversight of the nation's coal mines. They are accusing the agency that has that job with failing to prevent the deaths of 14 miners in West Virginia. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia said, 14 men in the span of 3 weeks. These deaths, I believe, were entirely preventable. Senator Arlen Specter expressed anger after the acting head of the Mine Safety and Health Administrations left the roughly two-hour hearing halfway through. Specter said he would try to pass a federal legislation this year that would stiffen penalties against coal operators that would violate safety rules and would require that up-to-date safety equipment would be placed in mines. Specter called for an end to the practice in which coal operators can whittle down fines they receive through an appeals process. As an example, he cited the reduction of fines from $435,000 to $3,000 against a coal company in charge of an Alabama mine where 13 people were killed in 2001. Witnesses at the hearing debated the merits of the new safety equipment. One device available in about a dozen mines allows people above ground to send text messages to miners below.
Experts say the breadth of information one could glean from a person's phone records is alarming. Peter Swire, a law professor at Ohio State University and former Clinton administrative privacy official, said It's everyone your teenager called from home, whom is dating whom, contacts with reporters for politicians. The website AmericaBlog.com said this month it will be able to buy the cell phone records of former Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark. All the site needed, it said, was Clark's cell phone number and a credit card payment of $89.95. And it received 100 calls he made over a three-day period last November. The phone companies say they're aggressively trying to stop those who would sell their customers private call information. Singular Wireless said it won a temporary restraining order against the companies involved with several websites offering phone records.
A former campaign manager of Tom DeLay, who also ran an organization linked to disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, was subpoenaed by a Texas prosecutor yesterday. Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle filed documents in Austin seeking records from Robert Mills in connection with a probe of DeLay, who is awaiting trial in Texas on money laundering charges. Earle wants information about a $500,000 political contribution made in 1999 by the National Republican Congressional Committee to the U.S. Family Network. Mills, DeLay's 1996 campaign manager, was president of the U.S. Family Network. The Washington Post reported that donations to a U.S. Family Network came from clients of Abramoff, who has pleaded guilty to federal charges in a congressional corruption investigation. DeLay has denied that donations to U.S. Family Network influenced his legislative agenda. DeLay is accused of laundering campaign money used in 2002 races for the state legislature. He stepped down as House Majority Leader last year when he was indicted. He also has come under scrutiny in the Abramoff investigation, but denies wrongdoing.
A U.S. Army officer was guilty of negligent homicide in the death of an Iraqi general during an interrogation, a military court ruled on Saturday. Chief Warrant Officer Louis Welshoffer is the highest-ranking Army officer tried on murder charges arising from the Bush administration's campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq. He was found guilty of murder and faces up to 3 years in prison when sentencing takes place today. The court heard that Welshoffer caused the death of Major General Abed Haman Wahoush by putting him headfirst in a sleeping bag, tying electrical cord around him, straddling him, and covering his mouth. Welshoffer was also found guilty of negligent dereliction of duty, which carries a sentence of up to 3 months. He was acquitted on charges of assault by a jury made up of Army officers. The U.S. military had believed that Mawahush was in charge of growing insurgency in western Iraq. Prosecutors told the court that Welshoffer had crossed a line and had not upheld the Geneva Convention. Welshoffer's attorney noted that several witnesses were granted immunity from prosecution in exchange for cooperating.
President Bush told opponents of abortion yesterday that their views would eventually prevail and urge them to work to convince more Americans of the rightness of our cause. On the 33rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, Bush addressed activists by telephone from Manhattan, Kansas, and called their goals noble. Bush said, "We, of course, seek common ground where possible. We're working to persuade more of our fellow Americans of the rightness of our cause. And this is a cause that appeals to the conscience of our citizens and is rooted in America's deepest principles. History tells us that with this such a cause, we will prevail." The rally was held to protest the 1973 decision, which opponents hope to overturn someday. As anti-abortion activists gathered in Washington and elsewhere across the country, Bush headed for Kansas, where he spoke about the war on terrorism. As he has in the past years, the president phoned in his support rather than attend in person, this according to Reuters.
Halliburton was accused by former employees yesterday of supplying contaminated water to American troops and Iraqi civilians at a Marine base in Ramadi, according to The Guardian. The claims by former employees who gave evidence to Democratic senators yesterday was backed up by internal Halliburton emails relating to the untreated water and the health problems it had caused in Camp Junction City, as the Ramadi base is called. The level of contamination was roughly two times the normal contamination of untreated water from the Euphrates River. Halliburton has denied the claims of its former workers. The Marine Corps says the water quality records for last year showed no sign of problems. Halliburton now runs a water treatment plant at the base. However, another former KBR employee Ben Carter, a water expert, said he found evidence of contamination last March and immediately sent an email about the problem to his colleagues. Carter said he resigned in early April after Halliburton officials failed to take any action.
The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State has said a U.S. beef shipment to Japan that led to a renewed ban on American beef imports was an unacceptable mistake. Outlawed spinal material was found in a batch of veal from New York, triggering the new ban. The move came after months after a two-year embargo on U.S. beef imposed over fears of BSE, or mad cow disease, was lifted. Tokyo had lifted a ban on imports of cows aged 20 months or younger as long as parts thought to have a higher risk of carrying BSE, such as brains, spines, and bone marrow, were removed. Meanwhile, a team of experts are in Japan to meet Japanese officials in an effort to persuade Tokyo not to reimpose a total ban on imports. The previous ban halted trade worth some $1.4 billion a year, as the Japanese market is one of the biggest for American beef. BSE was found in U.S. cattle at the end of 2003, prompting Japan to impose the import ban. Eating beef from infected cattle can cause a fatal human brain disorder, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
President Bush said yesterday that he was concerned a future nuclear-armed Iran could blackmail the world. But a setback for U.S.-European Union efforts to crack down on Iran over its disputed nuclear program, the U.N. nuclear watchdog chief ruled out advancing a wide-ranging report on the issue in a time for a February 2nd crisis meeting of his agency. In remarks at Kansas State University, Bush cited Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's expressed wish for Israel to be wiped off the map as a sign that Iran sought a nuclear arsenal. Earlier, Iranian officials said they did not fear the Western threats over their atomic energy drive and vowed to pursue uranium enrichment, even if sent to the Security Council. But Tehran, which denies Western suspicions that it seeks to build atomic bombs, also urged more dialogue with the European Union to resolve a standoff that is jacking up world oil prices. Western powers have urged IAEA chief Mohammad Al-Baradei to make a broad accounting of Tehran's nuclear project to the special IAEA meeting they called for February, rather than wait for a regularly scheduled March 6 session. This, according to Reuters.
The Leon County, Florida Supervisor of Elections, Ian Sanchez's job is to make sure voting is free of fraud. But the most brazen effort lately to manipulate elections results in this Florida locally was carried out by Sancho himself. KBOO's Kirk Vandeveer reports.
Four times over the past year, Sancho told computer specialists to break into his voting system. And on all four occasions, they did, changing results with what the specialists describe as relatively unsophisticated hacking techniques. To Sancho, the results showed the vulnerability of voting equipment manufactured by Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems, which is used by Leon County and many other jurisdictions around the country. Diebold and some officials have criticized Sancho's experiments and said his conclusions about the vulnerability of electronic voting systems are unfounded. The questions about electronic balloting have become widespread as states and counties move to upgrade equipment, as required by the 2002 Help America Vote Act. The law and new state regulations were enacted to make voting more accessible and more accurate, a response to the controversy generated by the contested outcome in Florida in the 2000 presidential election. For KBOO News, I'm Kirk Vandeveer.
In Florida, an airline passenger bit a fellow traveler yesterday, then jumped out of the plane as it was on the tarmac. He was subdued with a stun gun. The man was taken to a hospital from the Fort Lauderdale airport, the Broward County Sheriff's officer said. It was unclear whether he or the passenger who was bitten were hurt. The Continental Airlines flight had been delayed for about 30 minutes, and as the Boeing 737 began to taxi, the man started yelling to get off. He ran to the front of the plane and banged on the windows and the cockpit door. As passengers and crew members tried to restrain him, he bit a passenger. When the pilot depressurized the cabin, the man opened a door, jumped onto the tarmac, and began running toward the terminal. Deputies say they zapped him with a stun gun after he resisted arrest.
The UK has been ranked fifth best in the world at tackling domestic and global environmental problems, and the US 28th. The first Environmental Performance League tables will be launched this week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The tables, produced by international scientists and researchers from Yale and Columbia universities, in the U.S. ranked 133 countries according to how they tried to tackle 16 global and domestic problems and met domestic and world targets. New Zealand came top, followed by Sweden, Finland, and the Czech Republic. The report said the world's poorest countries, mainly in Africa, came bottom largely because their governments had no resources to address the mounting problems of drinking water, indoor air pollution, sanitation, and loss of forests. The pilot list, which is based on environmental health and habitat quality indicators, such as greenhouse gas emissions, park protection, and air and water quality, found major differences between countries with similar legacies of pollution, resource degradation, and wealth. The report found that good governance emerges as a critical driver on environmental performance.
Pakistan's Prime Minister will be meeting with President Bush later this morning at the White House. Shaukat Aziz says he's sure the Washington visit will bring the two nations to a higher plane. During a speech last night at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Aziz played down strained relations, calling America our friend and ally. The speech came a day after he condemned this month's airstrike near the Afghan-Pakistani border, saying the U.S. failed to notify Islamabad beforehand. The airstrike killed at least 13 people, including women and children. Although the attack failed to get al-Qaeda's number two man, Pakistani intelligence officials have said they believe four top al-Qaeda operatives were killed.
Two German engineers are the latest foreigners abducted in Iraq. Gunmen seized them today near an oil refinery about 150 miles north of Baghdad. More than 250 foreigners have been taken hostage in Iraq, either by insurgents or gangs, since the U.S.-led invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein. At least 39 have been killed. And there's still no word on the fate of Jill Carroll, the American journalist who was taken January 7th.
The trial of Saddam Hussein descended further into chaos as the chief judge in the case was replaced for the second time in a week. Just days after assurances by U.S. and Iraqi officials that the case would proceed without further altercations, Saeed al-Hamashi, the latest presiding judge who replaced Rizgar Amin, was forced to step down yesterday. The court trying to the ousted Iraqi president has now appointed Rauf Abdelrahman, a Kurd, to the post. The announcement was immediately followed by a declaration by Saddam Hussein's legal team that the trial had lost all credibility and should be moved to another country. The demise of Hamashi followed revelations that he was being investigated by Iraq's De-Ba'athification Committee for his alleged close links to the former regime. American officials had said last week that the De-Ba'athification laws introduced in 2003 did not apply to the tribunal. To add to the confusion, the government is yet to accept Amin's resignation. The judge, who is Kurdish, resigned in protest, he said, at American interference in his handling of the proceedings. This according to The Independent.
Private contractors in Iraq are preparing to leave as U.S. money runs out and the government ministries plan to take charge in the reconstruction effort, according to The Washington Times. The engineering and construction giant Fluorocorp is one of the biggest private sector employees in Iraq. At one time, they had 250 to 300 people from the United States in Iraq and employed about 20,000 Iraqis. But now, as the U.S.-funded part of the reconstruction effort comes to a close, Fluoro has roughly 100 Americans left in the country and is phasing out the Iraqi jobs. Most U.S.-funded projects are scheduled to be completed by the end of this year, and it is unlikely that any significant new U.S. funds will be forthcoming. Iraqi government ministries, which will be taking over responsibility for the reconstruction effort, tend to issue much smaller contracts that do not interest large U.S. companies. Retired Colonel Paul Hughes of the United States Institute of Peace is quoted as saying that the U.S. Congress has made it clear that it will not provide any more money. The World Bank has estimated in 2003 that would take $56 billion to rebuild Iraq's infrastructure, and the United States appropriated $18.7 billion towards the effort. Much of went to build specific projects. Some contractors say privately that they do not want to deal with the Iraqi government and that without the protection and support of the U.S. military, it is simply not safe to work in Iraq.
Venezuela's vice president yesterday told top Republican John McCain he could, quote, go to hell, for suggesting that, quote, wackos were governing the oil-producing South American country, this according to Reuters. Commenting on U.S. reliance on foreign oil supplies, McCain told Fox News Sunday, "We better understand the vulnerabilities that our economy and our lives have when we're dependent on Iranian mullahs and wackos in Venezuela." Venezuela, the world's fifth largest oil exporter and an OPEC member, supplies 15% of U.S. energy imports. But ties between Washington and left-wing President Hugo Chavez have deteriorated rapidly since his 1998 election. Venezuela and the United States often trade barbs over Chavez's self-described socialist revolution. His close political ties with U.S. foe Cuba, and his criticism of U.S. foreign policies. U.S. officials dismiss it as popular rhetoric, but they say they worry Chavez has become a destabilizing influence by interfering in the politics of his South American neighbors.
China and Saudi Arabia have signed a host of agreements during a landmark visit to Beijing by King Abdullah, the most important one on future energy cooperation. The symbolic visit could signal much closer cooperation on oil-related projects. After arriving in Beijing on Sunday, King Abdullah met China's President Hu Jintao and is scheduled to meet Premier Wen Jiabao today. A large Saudi government and business delegation is on a three-day visit to Beijing to discuss a wide range of energy-related projects, including oil refining, natural gas, and mineral exploration. Details of the high-level discussions between the Saudis and Chinese have been shrouded in uncertainty. Specifics were not publicized, and talks on possible military cooperation and terrorism are also thought to be on the agenda. China has a sizable Muslim minority, particularly in its western regions, and some of those groups have grown disenchanted with Beijing's rule. China, the world's most voracious energy consumer, relies heavily on Saudi oil. Saudi Arabia is the country's top oil supplier. This from the Financial Times.
A Turkish court dropped criminal charges against best-selling author Orhan Pamuk on Monday, a defense lawyer said, in a move which the European Union described as good news for freedom of speech in Turkey. The trial had cast a shadow over the Muslim country's drive to join the 25-nation EU bloc after it began membership talks last October. Pamuk, seen by many as the Nobel Literature Prize contender, was charged under Article 301 of a new penal code, which forbids insulting Turkish identity. The EU has called on Turkey to amend the article, which has allowed nationalist prosecutors to put Pamuk and scores of other writers and academics on trial for insulting Turkishness or state institutions. Pamuk upset nationalists by telling a Swiss newspaper last year nobody in Turkey dared mention the killing of 1 million Armenians during World War I or 30,000 Kurds in recent decades. Lawyers said the court dropped the case after Justice Ministry failed to give permission for it to go ahead as was required under the country's old penal code. He added that the ruling was not binding for other similar cases.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 24th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO News volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is AM News and Public Affairs Director. Liam Delta is on the board right now. Now I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson. Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR.
Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. And remember to take a look at the KBOO website, all new, all better.
If you have most of your marbles, come and play. The newsroom always needs fresh blood. To volunteer, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202.